Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass
against us. Phil was wonderful. He would let anybody get arrested.
Americans are hung up on an Anglo-Saxon concept of law.
If this was going to be your very last day, would you find all of the words you needed to say?
We still haven't been able to understand, you know, the psychic or the spiritual effect of loving the body.
Celebrate all the choices you have made in the past. If you knew in the morning it would be
very, very,
your
very hopeful,
last.
Very hopeful.
This is a special holiday edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On today's special edition of Peace Watch, we celebrate the life of a great peacemaker, Philip Berrigan, who passed away December 6, 2002, at the age of 79. Phil Berrigan and his brother Dan, both Catholic priests, gained national prominence for opposing the Vietnam War by burning draft files with homemade napalm. Rooted in his faith, Philip's commitment to resisting U.S. militarism continued. With the support of his community, he was arrested over 100 times and spent 11 years of his life behind bars for nonviolent civil resistance. Pacifica producer Laurel Padgett-Seekins compiled this tribute from over 30 years of audio recordings of Phil Berrigan.
I'm a World War II veteran. I was commissioned as an infantry officer in France in 1944 because of my involvement in the military for about 3.5 years and my participation in the European theater of operations. I had to slowly unlearn many of the lessons and falsehoods that I had picked up. This took a long and laborious course. I came home and at the behest of my family went to Holy Cross College, and then entered the Josephite Seminary in the same year. And after 5 years, I was ordained a Catholic priest. And then my true education began, I believe. Our apostolate was to African Americans, and most of our missions and schools were in the Deep South. Black people began to educate me. So I joined the civil rights struggle and became active in the Deep South. In Selma, Alabama, in New Orleans, Montgomery, Alabama, and many other places. From that, I learned about the war in Vietnam and African-American participation in it. While teaching in New Orleans at a black high school, I saw my students recruited by the Air Force and by the Army and Marines and other branches of the service, thinking nothing of it in those days. But nonetheless, the lessons of the civil rights movement struck deeply into me and found a chord of response, especially the nonviolence of Martin Luther King. He, in turn, of course, was highly influenced by the nonviolence of Jesus and by Gandhi. In a very true sense, the civil rights leaders taught me. I became active against the war in about 1962. Through legal measures mostly. I did not learn about civil disobedience until the mid-60s. In 1967, while the March on the Pentagon happened, I went with three other friends to the Baltimore Customs House and we poured our blood on 1A draft files. For this, we were indicted, went to trial, while Baltimore and Washington and New York City and other major American cities burned because of the assassination of Martin Luther King in early 1968. I was awaiting sentencing for the Baltimore Customs House action when we drew together, several of us, the Catonsville Nine.
We went into this draft board, local draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, had the place all scoped out, knew what we were dealing with by way of clerks, went in there with a firm conviction we couldn't hurt anybody, and we assigned ourselves tasks. One would watch the clerks and prevent them from calling the police. One would loot the 1A draft files and pile them into wire trash burners that we brought along. One would interpose themselves from the remaining two or three clerks and prevent them from stopping the action. So everybody had a job. So it only took us about, I'd say, maybe 10 minutes. And we got everything we needed, and we took them to the parking lot. We burned these draft files with homemade napalm and made it known to the press that we were doing that. And then waited for arrest.
God of the poor man, this is how the day began. Eight co-defendants, I'd fill up there again. Oh, and only a layman.
But neither at the Customs House nor at Catonsville do I wish my actions reduced to a question of acquittal or conviction. We have already made it clear that our dissent runs counter to more than the war. We have been accused of arrogance, but what of the fantastic arrogance of our leaders? What of their crimes against the people, the poor and powerless? Still, no court will try them. For those in whose manicured hands the power of the land lies, we say to them, lead us in justice, and there will be no need to break the law. You men of power, I also have a dream. Federal judges, district attorneys, marshals, all against the war in Vietnam. You men of power, you have told us that your system is reformable. Reform it then, and we will help with all our conviction and energy, in jail or out.
My country saw were priests who broke the law. First it was a question, then it was
the jury has concluded its deliberations and is ready to report its findings.
The taking of the verdict in criminal action number 28-111. Members of the jury, defendant Philip Berrigan, guilty.
For this, I was given a 6-year sentence and was denied bail and went to jail in May of 1968. I was released on bail about Christmas time of 1968 and then began to work solidly against the war, participating with friends in the formation of draft board raiding groups, nonviolent raiding groups, and did this until ordered to surrender in April of 1970. My brother, myself, George Mishy, and Mary Moyland at this point went underground.
It seems kind of funny to me, and probably will to the radio audience, that we're interviewing ourselves in a way. There's not too many reporters here in the underground, and it would be kind of difficult for us to involve other persons in an interview situation without some risk to them. And the risk to us is that a warrant is now out for our arrest and authorities will be looking for us. We plan to provide them the opportunity to pick us up in a kind of public sanctuary rally situation.
We were very sensitive. I remember some of the conversations we had. We were very sensitive to the implication that might be extended that we were cooperating with the justice of the government. So to appear hat in hand and to present ourselves according to their orders, we found a great deal of difficulty with that, since we think our main goal in life and our main business is resistance. Then it would seem our final apprehension by federal authorities and our final jailing ought to be done somewhat on our terms rather than theirs, since in nonviolent philosophy we attempt to keep control over situations and apply the philosophy of nonviolence to them. It just strikes me, too, that regarding the rationale for being underground, so to speak, is perhaps more concisely stated by our press release, which was circulated this morning. It said this: we have trouble with surrender, even as we have trouble with official notions of crime or justice, because this government refuses to represent the poor or blacks or students. It does not represent us. If it were truly representative, we would not be sent to jail, nor would it suppress our black brothers and sisters. and send to battlefield murder or to death our young brothers, and then suck dry for profit's sake our poor brothers here and abroad. And so it becomes a problem to us, as it has to the remainder of the world, placing us all in a common dilemma of survival.
The actions that get us to this position of being arrested and facing the jail sentence raise interesting questions to many movement people. That is, actions that have been called the property actions, beginning with our own, with the blood on draft files, and going through the Catonsville Nine.
There again, I have absolutely no quarrel with the destruction of exploitative property. The way this country is hung up on property is a cause for constant astonishment and, shame. Well, on the part of some people, even rage. However, the central question intrudes once again and has to face it. You don't build a movement without people. And I say the action has to be directed along those lines. I would consider people who are working to encourage desertion in the armed forces doing something immensely more significant than bombing, simply because they are changing the lives of people. I run into deserters from the armed forces who, because of the concern that the peace community has given them, have radically changed their lives. This is much more significant than doing $100,000 worth of damage to a building in terms of building a movement which will turn the society around in a human fashion, see, and which will hold it to its rhetoric and to its great political documents, and will get it off the backs of the remainder of mankind, because that's essentially the position of America today. We're on the backs of people in the remainder of the world.
I've met so many guys in draft counseling who just couldn't hack the jail.
I guess the last thing that you and I would, the last thing that either of us would attempt would be to be apodictic and, well, pretty authoritarian about projecting our views on jail to other people. But just in the objective order, I think it is a fact that Americans are hung up on an Anglo-Saxon concept of law. This is very, very rigidly ingrained in us, and we only with a supreme reluctance do we break the law, those of us who have come from the middle class. And jail has something to do with that, because jail is a consequence of breaking the law here in the West. And our fear of jail and our apprehension in face of it comes from this exaggerated notion of what public law is. And the fact that we really don't reconcile that with higher human laws, see, or divine laws, if people believe in them. There are vast potentials that can be explored in jail, and it can be, depending on the person and his spiritual resources, it can be an extremely enriching experience. But I think our freedom, goes back to this, well, appreciation of where we are and what we ought to be doing.
The tape of Phil and co-defendant Dave Eberhardt interviewing themselves was played on Pacifica station WBAI in April of 1970. The FBI caught Phil after 2 weeks underground.
I started serving my time at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and was there until August or September of that year, when I was switched to Danbury Federal Institution in Danbury, Connecticut, and was there for the next 2.5 to 3 years.
Even after the end of the Vietnam War, Berrigan continued his resistance to U.S. militarism and nuclear weapons. Throughout the course of his life, he was arrested over 100 times and spent a total of 11 years behind bars. In 1980, he and seven others started the International Plowshares Disarmament Movement when they entered a General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, to enact the prophecy of Isaiah.
We had friends up in Media, PA, that had been demonstrating at plant number 9, General Electric, for about 2 years. So they suggested that the prophecy of Isaiah might be implemented there, and it was a completely new idea to us, that we would be expected to take the initiative when the government wasn't willing to do that, and beat swords into plowshares, beat nuclear weapons into scrap.
All the ones I've been involved in, I've been involved in six of them, have been against first strike nuclear weaponry, or the components of first strike nuclear weaponry. Generally speaking, and this is kind of a rule of thumb, you pour your blood on the first strike apparatus, see, and you lay the hammer to it. You dismantle it as much as you can without being vandalistic, without being charged as a vandal. See, the symbol of disarmament, which means the hammer especially, has to be protected so it can speak to people. It's a household tool, huh? It's a tool of construction. It's a universal tool. Everybody has hammers, you know. And we have built these weapons, and now we have to unbuild them, and the hammer is at hand. It's available to us, and so you use it. So on a Trident submarine, well, the hatches for D-5, which is the latest version of a Trident missile, will be open, and the hatch covers have to be watertight, see, and you belabor them, and then they have to pull them all out, and they have to send them back for remilling, you know, and this is tremendously expensive, and it holds up the commissioning of the submarine, see, sometimes weeks or months. This has happened time and time again. And then we took on, there have been about 3 or 4 actions against this new killer destroyer called an Aegis destroyer. This destroyer, the Navy boasts, it's the most powerful ship afloat because it can ward off simultaneously using this fiendishly cybernetic fire control system. It can ward off attacks from under the sea, from surface craft, see, from aircraft and bombing, and from shore batteries simultaneously. Take them all on, so they boast. See? And meanwhile, you know, it carries a lethal number of Tomahawk cruise missiles, all of which are nuclear-tipped. So when we went aboard the USS the Sullivans, pretty much 2 of us were disarmed immediately because they had armed young sailors running all over those decks 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. Bread is up like that. So they ripped off my hammer and my blood and threw it overboard. They did the same with Tom Lewis. 2 broke through to the missile hatches and began to belabor them and pour their blood on it. Only Steve Kelly got into the guts of the ship and headed for the pilot house, which is the navigational center of the ship, and of course immobilized that with hammers and with blood. And God knows how long it took them to fix that.
I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion.
We say that these are annihilatory weapons. They're true weapons of mass destruction. And we believe that they're the taproot of violence in the West here, because any people who would make the decision and would learn to love the company of the bomb and its use in certain circumstances against another people are mad. And we still haven't been able to understand, you know, the psychic or the spiritual effect of loving the bomb here in this country. And that's one of the things you free yourself of when you do a plowshares action. You no longer love the bomb. You've taken some measures against it. Yet you're saying, look, I won't pay for it. I won't work on it. See, I won't feed it with my silence. I won't remain passive while it exists. You're saying all those things, and you're liberating yourself from that bomb. So we say that the prophecy of Isaiah, where people beat swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, that goes right to the heart of it. And that backs up on the Sermon on the Mount, which says, you must love your enemies. It's in the imperative mood. You love your enemies. Christ commands us to love our enemies. And indeed, that's what we need to do in order to achieve peace on earth. We've got to love our enemies.
Phil's commitment was grounded in community, which he felt provides the necessary support for a life of resistance and also holds an individual to higher responsibilities. In 1973, Phil and his wife Liz McAllister founded Jonah House, a resistance community in Baltimore, Maryland, where they raised their three children.
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. We hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. We work with our hands to earn what we need for our living and our work. And that means supporting any effort towards resistance and peace. And it's been that way now since 1973. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions, but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society.
Would you find all of the words you needed to say to the ones that you have hurt or loved along the way? If you knew that this was going to be your very last day, if you knew in the morning this would be your last, would you kneel and pray? Would you feast or fast? Would you celebrate all the choices you have made in the past?
In one of the last interviews he gave, Phil spoke to Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian and myself about the possibility of a war on Iraq and the growing peace movement.
The people of this country are slowly waking up and slowly declaring their opposition to this war. If war breaks out in Iraq, it will be of the same caliber as the type we waged in Vietnam. That is total war. And I mean by that, you totalize the assault on not only the combatants of the army and the Air Force of Iraq, but also civilian population, the infrastructure, the soil, the water, the air. You assault the whole environment. And we will certainly use depleted uranium again, as we used it in the first Iraqi war and in Bosnia and Yugoslavia against the Serbs.
What can the current movement against the war in Iraq learn from lessons of anti-war movement against the Vietnam War?
Well, in the Vietnam War, there was strong elements of civil disobedience, and that's almost totally lacking today. And I mean by that draft resistors, young guys who refused to fight, and I mean by that some who fled to Canada or Sweden or France, and others who did these scores, or maybe over 100 draft board raids against Selective Service. And then many of them, myself included, stood by for arrest and went to jail. I did 40 months over Catonsville. So that's largely lacking today. And we found by experience that as the situation grows more critical, people begin to ask deeper and deeper questions about what their responsibilities are.
In my study of history, it seems like the Catonsville Nine action was one of the decisive actions against the Vietnam War, and that it sort of sparked a lot of debate within particularly the religious community in the United States. And sort of in the absence of the draft right now, what do you see as some comparable place that we could target to wake people up again now?
I don't know, Laurel. You're speaking about a catalytic action, huh? Yeah, I don't know at this point. Maybe it will have to be some American bodies coming back from Iraq.
Are you hopeful of the growing anti-war movement?
Very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful. Because, you know, we all experienced 9/11. And we did realize the plurality that Bush had by way of support. And we did see the country go crazy with flags and all of that. Well, now a lot of that is being taken back. And people are beginning to, in a very sobering and responsible way, they're beginning to rock back on their heels and say, there's something fishy about this. And, of course, the fishiest thing is the war on terrorism, which is a big swindle. It's not a war on terrorism at all. A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible because we're the number one terrorists. It's impossible, absolutely impossible.
Is there any final thoughts you'd like to add?
Well, I must say this, that under the aegis of all of this, under the heading of all of this, there's very little being said about preemptive nuclear strike and about nuclear weapons in general. And the lengths to which we're willing to go in order to fund this. And as far as I can discover, we're willing to go well into the trillions to fund this.
Your kingdom come.
And this is number two.
Your will be done
number two.
On earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory, now and forever. Amen.
Phil died December 6, 2002, surrounded by his family and friends at Jonah House in Baltimore, Maryland. We'll be right back after this break with the voices of some of the many who were inspired by his life.